Today's podcast is also sponsored by Sonos. For the first time ever, Sonos is offering the listeners of Game of Thrones podcast 10% off one order of $2,500 or less for any product on Sonos.com. This offer is available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. Use the promo code GOT10, capital G, capital O, capital T, 10 at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we're back for, I think, our final wrap-up show of the season.
Season 7.
Yeah, Season 7. If you didn't know by the title of the podcast you clicked on, we're doing the spoiler version of it. Spoiler? I never know how to say that.
Yeah, you did it.
Okay.
There was an attempt.
I know we've got a lot of feedback today. We talked about a lot of stuff on the non-spoiler one, mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see what else people have come up with that might be more spoilery.
Well, let me satisfy that curiosity. Conan O.B.
Connor
O.B.
Okay.
Connor O.B. I can only assume it's a pseudonym for Conan.
Uh-huh.
There are three main things that could come from this Volantis deal that I think could be significantly important to the outcome of the war. Now, you'll recall that that's where Lady Melisandre is heading off to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Tyrion first met this kind of like cult of the Red Priest and Priestesses. There's three significant things. Valyrian steel smithing, Valyrian steel, and a whole mess of R'hllor-related people that I think is exciting.
We've got the Valyrian steel guy on board. We don't need the Valyrian steel.
Who?
Gendry. Gendry's on board. Sam's there.
You don't know.
Yeah.
He doesn't have the recipe.
He will.
Anyway, Connor says, in the show when ice is being melted down by Tywin to create the two new Valyrian steel swords for House Lannister, it is mentioned that the smithy he brought to do the rework of the Valyrian steel came from Volantis specifically.
Hmm.
So that's exciting. There's at least one smithy there who can work with Valyrian steel. The latter two items are a package deal, I think. In Volantis, there is the main temple of the Lord of Light in Essos. This temple is said to be three times the size of the Great Sept of Baelor, and its walls are described by Tyrion as 100 hues of red, yellow, gold, and orange meeting and melding into the temple walls, dissolving one into another like clouds at sunset. What does this sound like to you? Jim?
Like,
Jim
it Jones. Sounds like clouds at sunset.
It sounds like a Bob Ross painting.
It does.
Happy little ripples. to Connor, it sounds a lot like every description of Valyrian steel that I've read or heard.
Okay.
Okay, I'll go with it. Secondly, remember the Red Priestess that met with Tyrion and Meereen Kinvara? Well, she just so happens to think that Dany is the prince that was promised Azor Ahai and told Tyrion that outright. She also just happens to be the High Priestess of the Temple. Wait, there's more. The Temple of the Lord of Light has its own private army of soldiers called the Fiery Hand. These guys, there are about 1,000 of them, are dedicated to protecting the sanctity of the Lord of Light and fight in some badass-sounding armor and robes with giant spears in the shape of flames. All in all, sounds pretty rad to me and can make an impact in the coming war. So, I don't know if you're suggesting that the Temple to the Lord of Light is actually constructed out of Valyrian steel, mm-hmm. because... No fucking way would
a whole
no
temple.
One. Yeah, and would no one notice a whole temple being made of Valyrian steel?
Uh-huh.
I like where your head's at as far as the smith, and I like the fact that we already have a main character going over there for some purpose and is going to come back, assuming that she's still serving light and life like she says she is. That might be interesting. Introduction to the fight. It would be kind of cool if a whole bunch of boats bearing, like, a flame came mm-hmm. up and just dumped a whole bunch of screaming religious fanatics onto the shores to unleash against somebody's army.
Yeah.
Is it cool enough to actually get into the final season of Game of Thrones without explanation?
It might be. I mean, they've certainly set up Melisandre as going over there to do something.
And they have the High Priestess they've already introduced. They've cast her. She's been yep. in two different seasons. Like, that there's enough there they could do that.
For sure. And she's also said, hey, I'm coming back because I got to die here. So we are going to see her again. I have faith in that. I think her with an army at her back would be kind of cool. I don't see any reason it couldn't happen.
It seems like that the male priests of the Lord of Light get the short end of the magical stick.
Do they?
Can they make a shadow baby?
Oh, that's a good question.
Shadow butt baby? Just
yeah.
I mean, it doesn't seem like that would work. Like, or they'd have to have the use of a non-magical woman. Oh, maybe they can get, if they combine with the Red Priestess, it's like a super shadow baby.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that sounds about right to me.
Unwilling to dip your toe into this theory?
No, Jim? No, it's a very good question, and I think we should maybe, if we ever have the opportunity, petition George Martin to answer it.
Yeah, I want to know what the male it could just be is it unfair that men are not allowed to carry children? I mean, is the way of the
I don't think I would call it unfair. No.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't want that privilege. I'm happy that I'm excluded from that. But yeah, like I wonder, whatever. Let's move on to Liz W. I'd like to hear your thoughts on the discovery of the direwolves in Book 1 now that Gendry has returned and we're all wondering why. If you recall, the direwolves were discovered orphaned as a result of a confrontation between a stag and the parent wolf, or at least the reader is led to believe that due to the remains of the stag antlers. Yeah, so that if you recall, they found that this direwolf looked like it was locked in mortal combat with a stag, and they'd both killed each other, and the direwolf pups were there trying to nurse from a dead direwolf mama. In the first book, the Starks read this as an omen, a bad omen for the relations between Ned and Robert. However, the rifts were essentially between Lannister Stark, not Baratheon and Stark. Now we have Gendry of Baratheon taking up a new bro relationship between him and the would-be Stark, Jon Snow. I also think Jon's words to Theon are important, that they belie a fluid understanding of family and a level of agency in determining who that is. At his core, Jon is Ned's son, even if Ned isn't his biological father. Given this, do you think the stag/direwolf foreshadowing might be relevant to Gendry's return and indicate a perilous future between he and Jon? I'll grant this is a bit tenuous and the wolves seem to have taken a back seat, but I'm going through the books and the remaining 18 months and this jumped right out at me. Watch out. That direwolf will get you if he's jumping out at the books at you. Exchange your book in for, or your pop-up book for the real thing. So
it's so long ago in the books. Like what, 20 years ago?
I mean, but you're talking, so are the hints that Jon is actually a secret Targaryen. Like,
yeah,
it's very hard to say what is and is not a deep cut for Martin nowadays.
Right, it's tough, especially with his writing style, you know, that mm-hmm. gardening sort of style. Mm-hmm. How much did he have the outline back then? Did he know Gendry was coming back at the end?
Right, and that's the thing about these omens and prophecies. You tend to look for, like, an initial fulfillment, and then is there a greater fulfillment? Or, you know, is this, like, a foreshadowing for the foreshadowing? I mean, my guess is that this is a bad omen, and it was a bad omen, because both the Baratheon and Stark houses end up essentially being destroyed in their current manifestations by the end of the War of the Five Kings. Now, Starks mm-hmm. made a bit of the comeback. Maybe, maybe this suggests that the Stark and Baratheon union will have a regrowth period, because just out of that violence, there came these six direwolf pups. I just feel like that's like it's a literal, like, you've got rebirth coming from death. So Gendry could be these are the muddy direwolf pups that are coming out of the corpse of the mother. I what do you think, Jim?
Yeah, my gut feeling on it is that it was meant to be an ominous bad omen for these characters, but it didn't quite play out that way. I agree with the emailer that, you know, it wasn't really Robert and Ned mm-hmm. that had the rift. It was more mm-hmm. the Lannisters and the Starks. So not like a red herring exactly, but just something that kind of has, you know, bad juju for the story going forward. But I don't view it as like carrying over through the entire story.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to go looking for trouble between the Baratheons and the Starks, I think there is a possibility that Gendry could fulfill part of what the fake Aegon or perhaps real Aegon and John Connington plot is. It's going to be yet another political complication or distraction. And they're setting up several of these. There's already the like, well, who's going to set up, who's going to be the who have the right to rule? Is it going to be Dany or John? Is Gendry going to like, you know, and also, are they going to really go through with that? Or is this going to be like after humanity's won the war, are they going to the Great War that John calls it? Are they going to sit down and immediately resume the petty grievances that, or are they going to break the fucking wheel? It could be that that's a false conflict that the heroes will swiftly overcome to show, to demonstrate all this bullshit is still there. It's human nature, but they're choosing a different path. I don't know. That's one way to look for it if you want to go looking for four gleams of trouble there. I just can't believe they're going to make Gendry into a bad guy.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, at his core, Robert Baratheon wasn't a bad guy. He was a terrible king, but not a bad man.
Maybe
he's a shitty man, even. Like, I just, you know.
In some ways, yeah.
But a lovable. You know, like, he's a rascal.
Uh-huh.
He's a rascal, that Bobby B.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, everybody. It's the last week of our Game of Thrones Season 7 coverage. I think we're going to have another opportunity to talk about this, but I wanted to let you know if you were unfamiliar. I put together a project called the Game of Thrones Charity Podpack. With about 9 others. I think there's 10 in total podcasts in this thing. It's basically us and nine other Game of Thrones podcasters all got together, produced special one-off episodes of our podcasts, and combined them all into a pod pack.
Among who is this August company?
There's a lot of people. We've got
Cast of Kings.
Cast of Kings. We've got A Storm of Spoilers. We've got Pot of Thrones. And
Jay and Jack.
I'll say 6 more.
Jay and Jack.
Yeah, Jay and Jack.
They're our podfathers.
Yeah, certainly. I've been listening to them for a long time since their Lost coverage, which was great and kind of influenced a lot of how we do podcasts here at Bald Move. So it was awesome to work with them. And if you want to get that, you can go to podpack.baldmove.com. It's $9, I think, to get all of it.
A buck a podcast.
Save a little bit of money. Yeah, you can buy it individually. So if you just want like Bald Move or you just want Storm of Spoilers or something, you can get the mini packs. But really, I mean, it goes to a good cause. We're giving 50% of the proceeds to charity. We're actually giving our entire cut to the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund.
One of the local Houston charities that have popped up.
To try and help people who've been affected by that, because we mistimed it. We didn't know there would be a natural disaster on our hands that needed our support.
And there's another one. I mean, like, shoot, there's is it Irma that's coming down, bearing down on Florida?
Oh, is there?
Could be a bad year in the Gulf. And we're thinking about you and trying to send some money your way.
Yeah, so if you're interested in, you know, getting some special content and helping in supporting charity, go to podpack.baldmove.com to check out the podpack and buy it.
Bob F. So we have Jamie Lannister on his way to Winterfell. When he gets there, he's going to have his first meeting with Bran since the fateful attempt at base jumping. Will this meeting trigger Bran's memory and help him remember the cause of his fall? This would give Arya a chance or a cause to take Jamie's life in his face. His face would give her the chance to get close enough to Cersei to mark off the biggest prize on her list. It would also fulfill the prophecy of the younger brother would be the one to take her life from a certain point of view. This is a pretty novel attempt to actually explain a situation where the Valonqar prophecy could come true in an Obi-Wan Kenobi kind of way.
Yeah.
Because all this is true. Like, Jamie's heading north. He's going to meet Bran. Like, what the hell is that going to be like? Is he going to... I
can't imagine. So, if I'm Bran and I discover, hey, I've got powers to see the past.
Right. That's the first thing you would do.
The first thing I'm going to do is go look at the moment I got paralyzed and, like, analyze it from every angle, right? Like, I'm going to have that thing on instant replay in my head 24/7.
Right.
There's no way he gets there and Bran goes, oh, yeah, I should check that out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It would behoove Jamie if he just confessed in the beginning, not make Bran have to get the card catalog out and go walking through the library. But I mean, that would be, I could see him being in, I don't know. Is that the thing is that a fitting end for Jamie? Cause he's no longer really the guy who would throw a kid out the window.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But he did commit that sin and he has to answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think losing his hand is answering for it enough. Now he's lost
it's debatable. Yeah.
He's lost his children. He's lost, mm-hmm. I mean, he's lost a hell of a lot more sins. I guess you're right. It is debatable. All right, good efforts for novelty there, Bob. Josh L. I wanted to note there is a zombie bear in the books. It's almost fitting that you're about to start season two when the Night's Watch headed to the Fist of the First Men, as that's where the zombie bear shows up in the books when the White Walkers attack the Fist. Of course, the actual attack is technically in A Storm of Swords in the prologue to season three, but close enough. That also explained why the Double Ds have wanted a zombie bear for 4 years, since they would likely have first brought that idea up when brainstorming that scene. But since they were still in the keep most battles off screen era of their budget, I guess it fell by the wayside.
Hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
I was wrong about that. Also, someone else reminded me that there was a zombie polar bear attack of Bran, Meera, and Jojen while they were still north of the wall trying to get to the cave of the Three-Eyed Raven. That they all managed to defeat with the help of Cold Hands and Summer, and they were all starving, so they actually ate the still writhing and moving and partially rotted bear meat. So there are, and that's also two examples, because I said I refused to comment on the possibility of animal whites in the books.
Yeah.
So they are definitely animal whites, and there's definitely zombie polar bears. Dexter G., there's something that everybody's ignoring, including you guys. The show has made a huge plot point out of genetic profiling. Ned Stark was killed in season one for realizing that all Baratheons were black of hair and all Lannisters were golden hair, the quote being, the seed is strong. The producers have been very consistent with keeping the type separate. Every Targaryen we've seen has platinum blonde hair. My theory is that we have been thrown a curveball. Ned's sister was not dragged off and raped by Rhaegar, but she was in fact raped by Robert Baratheon. who did love her and did start the war over here, but he told the story the way he wanted it to be told. Black-haired Jon Snow is not going to be found out to be a Targaryen, but is a Baratheon. All the evidence points to it.
All the evidence. The color of his hair points to it.
That's the point that cracked me up. Like,
yeah, come on. I mean,
all the genetic evidence points to one thing.
Yeah, we've talked about this many, many times. We don't view the color of an actor's hair to be a signifier of much of anything.
But that's, I mean,
because
that's,
they've changed the appearance of so many people in this show.
Right. And it's so fucking annoying because that's got to be still standing out as one of the dumbest plot points in the book. The whole seed is strong. And it would be kind of funny if, like, John, Aaron, and Ned Stark just had a stupid country bumpkin thumb up their ass view of biology.
Right.
And they drew the right conclusion from wrong evidence.
Maybe one of the books that Sam stole is going to be actual genetics study. Yeah. Oh, really? Punnett two blonde haired people can dummies. Have a dark haired
yeah.
child?
Yeah,
oh,
right.
No, it says it right here in Maester right. Poopstack's journals.
Yeah. Yeah, he kept the track of number of poop stacks and also every genetic pairing in all of Westeros.
Right. I just don't buy it. I don't think they're going to go that direction.
And that's the thing, like, I mean, first of all, I think this is a bad idea for Mulla. Because you say all, I mean, I have to strongly contradict you. Almost all of the evidence in the books points that Jon is the child. And, yeah. and to a fact, to an inversion of that. Would be very foolhardy in my mind. So mm-hmm. it's not like an idea of like the idea is sound, but I don't like it. I don't like anything about this theory. I think it's the original Seed is Strong is a garbage plot that mm-hmm. never doesn't even make sense in its own fucking universe. And isn't even consistent within the books, and the building theories on top of it just seem like I feel like I'm just beating the shit
yeah,
out of poor Dexter here.
You're dropping a poop stack.
Also, when you became a lumberjack and moved to Canada, it was terrible, Dexter. You let us all down. Also, Dexter, what's up with your name? You know, what kind of last initial is G? Go fuck yourself. No, I'm sorry. I just wanted to go over the top so you'd feel better.
Yeah.
I don't know why that would work.
Hopefully it lasts.
Because the seed is strong. It makes no sense. It doesn't have to.
The insults are strong.
Paul D. Had an epiphany about the fitting in for Jaime and Cersei's character arcs. I think we're starting to see the pieces fall into place that will set up the dramatic end for Jaime and Cersei, and I believe it will mirror Jaime's slaying of the Mad King Aerys during Robert's Rebellion.
Yeah.
Flashing back, as you know, the Kevin Lannister and his troops are at the Tywin or Kev? And one of the Lannisters. At his troops, with his troops at the gates prior to the sack of King's Landing, the Mad King Aerys sensed his imminent demise and ordered his master pyromancer to ignite the caches of wildfire hidden throughout King's Landing. Jaime, mm-hmm. to protect the city, killed him and murdered Aerys, becoming forever known as the Kingslayer. I think the show is setting up a similar ending for Jaime, Cersei, and Qyburn. We know Jaime is heading north to fight alongside the North in a true battle of the living versus the dead. But if and when that battle is won by the living, we can certainly expect Jon and Dany to march south to claim the Iron Throne from Cersei, who abandoned them in this fight. I believe this is going to mirror Robert Baratheon's army marching south on King's Landing during his rebellion. So Jaime rides ahead to try to reason with Cersei, urging her to save her own life by surrendering to the approaching army. Perhaps similar to Aerys, Cersei will let Jaime through the gates to join her in protecting her seat on the throne and also their new child. However, Jaime will not be able to convince Cersei, and she will be convinced that all is lost for her. Wanting to protect her baby from an invading army's hands, similar to what she was preparing to do with Tommen in the poison during Stannis' attempted sack, Cersei will order Qyburn to ignite new wildfire caches under this King's Landing to burn it to the ground. Cersei's already shown Jaime she is willing to use wildfire to murder hundreds, if not thousands, of innocents, and Jaime would be convinced she'd do it again if put in a corner. In this situation, I believe Jaime will have to fulfill his character arc by doing what he's done before. So there you go. There's a few more paragraphs, but has Jaime fulfill his larger purpose as the king / queen slayer. It also fulfills the Valonqar prophecy. I would not be surprised if some version of this is what ends up happening.
Yeah, the details are all, like, you know, just kind of pure fan fiction at this point. But I think overall, like the narrative structure of that makes a ton of sense.
And that's where I think it stands apart from mere fan fiction, is it has a sense of historical significance. It has a sense of kind of like these themes recurring in Martin's works. It also satisfies the Valonqar prop. Like, you know, there is it's not long on evidence, but as far as, you know, plot mechanics and character motivations and wrapping up things in a nice, neat end, and a truly tragic situation for Jaime. Like, I don't imagine Jaime ever loved the Mad King. It sounded like he was over him as soon as he joined the Kingsguard and kind of saw what the hell was going on.
Yeah,
but he did, like, truly love Cersei. I don't think anyone would argue otherwise. Cersei, loving Jaime back? I don't know, but I like it. I like it.
Yeah.
Allison P., like a lot of people, I'm a big hater of this whole plot to take a white to meet Cersei. On its face, it seemed far out of character for just about every one of the major players. I found it particularly irksome that Tyrion was the one who came up with the plot. Tyrion knows Cersei so well. At one point in the show, it's even said that no one knows her better than him, yet he misjudges her so egregiously in devising the plot and apparently believing that she will get on board with him. Which got me to thinking, what if Tyrion's motive was not to convince Cersei, but to convince her brother Jaime instead? What if she knew that Cersei, or what if he knew that Cersei is too far gone to ever convince, but Jaime, who's more reasonable and logical, could be persuaded? Not only would bringing a white get Jaime on board to fight the White Walkers, but it could ultimately get him to turn on Cersei completely and help them in their fight for the throne. And they say that, and Jim, you say?
I say, I say, it seems almost too stupid. I'm with you here. It seems almost too stupid of Tyrion to think that this idea could ever work, that he would ever convince his sister to drop her arms and help him. And in that regard, I like the idea of this being something other than a plain reading of what's happening.
Right.
But I don't know. Like, what good does it do to have just Jaime? No armies, no anything. I suppose it separates the two, which are kind of feeding each other and making them both stronger. So by separating Cersei and Jaime, it reduces their overall power.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a good point.
But, I mean, aside from that, it seems like a big fucking risk to send 12 people, 7 of which are super important, north.
Other 5.
Yeah. To try to get Jaime, because Jaime isn't really important to their cause at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and here's the thing.
But maybe it's something else. But it just doesn't seem like it could possibly ever be the plain reading of the scenes that we've seen.
Also, why wasn't this in the script? If, like, it would have been, like, it'd been so easy for Tyrion to float this and, like, half a dozen people in the room be like, there's no fucking way Cersei was, and he could be like, but we don't have to convince Cersei. We just have to convince my brother. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, there was a little bit in that, like, when he was explaining, like, him going to meet with Jaime, like, I can't convince Cersei, but I can, like, you know, my brother will listen to me, blah, blah, blah. Like, I felt like that, if they just wanted to make that explicit, they should have. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you know, the fact that Tyrion partially accomplished his mission, like, I mean, you got to separate Tyrion's goal from his end result. His goal was to have Jaime convince Cersei to back them in this play, which even Jaime thought he did. So then the half goal was, well, he peels off Jaime, but he doesn't get Cersei.
Right.
Which still, like you said, that deprives her of valuable military counsel and a good to decent military leader and, you know, emotional support.
Right.
So, like I said, I like the theory, too. I just don't know why it wasn't explicit in the text.
Maybe that's not what they're doing.
No,
Yeah, that's not what they're going after.
I do think that the plain reading is that the Double D's thought that, I don't know why, but they thought that people would buy. Yeah, I don't know.
They thought that all these characters thought it was a sound plan.
And that's the thing. Like, if they had made explicit that everyone thinks this, I mean, they did. That's the thing. They did, but for the wrong reasons. Everyone says it's stupid because it's so dangerous.
And that's not the problem. It just doesn't work.
The danger is, like, storming Normandy was dangerous, but it was sound tactics. You have to start somewhere to take back France. Like, it'd be one thing if, you know, they decided to storm Australia.
It doesn't accomplish,
like,
the goal.
Well, the Aussies are dangerous. Plus, how does this win us the war? Like, what? I mean, that's the thing. Like, they only objected to how foolhardy and dangerous it was, not that even if they win that what how the hell is this going to make Cersei magically on their side?
Yeah.
And anyway, the less said about this the better, because like I feel like we've said our piece. I appreciate all attempts to try to make it seem logical in hindsight, and maybe we'll get there, but not quite yet. Raphael G., you both seem pretty convinced that Euron's going to pick up the Golden Company and essentially abscond with them since he has the gold and no reason to stay with Cersei. Abscond sounds very romantic.
Convinced.
Like he's going to Rhaegar the entire... Strong. He's going to be the Rhaegar to all the Golden Company's Lyanna. And
yeah.
And he's just... They're going to have a very, very nice life over
a blonde-haired baby.
Yeah, yeah. the seed is strong, but they don't sow. So how would their seed be strong?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Anyway, however, I'm not so sure about this because of the characterization of the Golden Company from the books.
Mm.
Although a common refrain from them is "beneath the gold, the bitter steel," in reference to their founding. Their actual words are "our gold, our bond is as good as gold." They're famous amongst the mercenary companies of Essos for never breaking a contract, which is why in the books it becomes big news when they break their contract with one of the Free Cities to join Aegon and Jon Connington. Only their oath to Targaryens is stronger than their word for their contract. Could this come into play in the show? It seems unlikely their characterization would vary so wildly that they'd be okay with Euron just up and forcing them to switch sides, breaking their contract with Cersei.
It could, yeah. I mean, if that's within the character, certainly.
The problem is this is only a book thing, so is it necessary for the Double Ds to respect all of this book lore that they... I mean, they could just be using the name because it sounds dope, and it's a nod to the book readers. And also, I have an inkling, and I talked of this in my conversation with Kim, that, you know, to the extent that some of this stuff, this Golden Company, Euron might be a little bit of a remix of the fake Aegon, or perhaps real Blackfyre Aegon, or maybe just real Aegon. That there's just this is just yet another further complication for the struggle to unite the human part of the realm. Maybe that's what they're doing. Like, you know, they're taking Euron's attempt to marry Dany with Aegon's attempt to impress Dany to woo her into a marriage alliance by conquering Westeros, and they're boiling those down into a stew, and the Golden Company got thrown in there, and that's going to be a blend and consolidation of all those plot lines.
Yeah, could be.
But as far as them actually, I mean, they'd have to take it to the extent that you're going, Raphael, they'd have to do a lot of like explaining, like, oh, the like, and they should have done it this season, like, oh, the Golden Company never breaks their contract. Maybe they did. Was that like when she was talking to Nestor or whatever the hell, the banker from the Iron Bank? Maybe they mentioned the Gold Company and the fact that they never break their oaths. Or
I mean, they might have mentioned it in passing, yeah.
But the fact that I'm struggling to remember it, maybe in you know, like if they did get it into the show, then I guess it satisfies my can you explain it in a 5 second previously on. But I just don't think they're playing at that level.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa. Starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role, and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis, Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before we get any further into the podcast, I just wanted to bring up our sponsor for this week, which is Sonos. And you've probably heard us talking about them for the last 5 weeks or so, five, three, something like that.
It's an odd number of weeks, to be sure.
It definitely, either one, three, or five, or 47. So they sent us a couple of setups. Aaron got one, I got the other. We hooked them up to our televisions, or at least I hooked them all up to my TV. Because I wanted to experience...
Oh, God, you weren't supposed to do that. It's like crossing the beams.
Well, they say I can.
Okay.
they don't say don't ever hook these up. They're meant to be played. But basically, it's a...
they want to be played.
It's an in-home sound system, and you can use them a couple of different ways. Like I said, I hooked them up in a 5.1 configuration with the play base hooked up to the TV, and then... all wirelessly, of course, the subwoofer and the two Play Ones, which are kind of satellite speakers for the rears. And I was, I'd say, blown away by the increase in audio fidelity, I'll call it.
Yeah.
That's a word that audiophiles use, right?
Sure.
It seriously was night and day. Like,
it's Greek for means sounds good.
Is that true?
Fidelity, yeah.
Sounds,
five
sounds
means
right
sound
to me.
And delity, good.
But... I've been listening to TVs with just the TV speakers, no like sound systems.
And also,
for
I was
probably like
this is, this,
10 years.
This used to be a pain point between you and I. You had yeah. the base model of a particular Samsung TV that has the worst tinny sound and speakers I've ever heard.
It was terrible, and the difference between like the music and the voices was such like a drastic change that you would turn it up to hear the voices, and you would get your head blown off by the score
right
when it came in. This sound system has pretty much cured all of that. Like,
yeah.
It is so well balanced. It sounds great. It really was night and day compared to my old TV speakers.
Now, I was my Samsung was one of the you know, it's an older, but it was still one of the like top of the line models, and it always had pretty good speaker system. But I had the same deal where if the mix wasn't just right, you'd have to turn up for dialogue and get blown out. I really appreciate the fact that there's a mode that you can put the play bass in where it emphasizes the dialogue.
Yeah.
So like even if it's like it's you can do so many cool customizations that the software automatically takes care of, and that was the one that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, especially for, you know, when I'm watching to get my outline together.
Yeah.
I'm like, what did they say on my old speakers? Now I'm just like, oh yeah, that's totally what they said. Cool. You've got yours hooked up in a different configuration.
Yeah, I didn't
right?
go with the 5.1. I went with the Playbase and the subwoofer, and I took my ones and sprinkled them throughout the house. There's one in the kitchen, one in the bedroom, and it's what's cool is you can expand or contract that mesh to be as big or small as you want. You can have all the speakers playing the same thing throughout the house, or you can have them all playing something completely different.
Yeah,
which is cool because you know you might want to be listening to some music upstairs while you want to watch TV. I've been using a lot because I cook. I do most of the cooking in my family, and we have this kind of like open floor plan where the kitchen, you can see the TV through the dining room through the kitchen. And a lot of times I have to crank up the TV to unbelievably loud levels to hear it. But now I can actually have the satellite speaker relaying to me, and I can still watch TV from far away and not be blown out the whole house with whatever I'm listening to.
That's
so
cool.
It's so flexible. And the fact that you don't have to run cords or wires anywhere, and the setup is super easy, just very impressive piece of gear.
Yeah, all of it being wireless is a really good feature. You just need power. So I've got my – I would never have set up a 5.1 if I had to run speaker wires, because it just – it's ugly.
Yeah.
But these are much easier. So, yeah, right now we're doing a promo with Sonos for the first time ever. They're offering listeners of the Game of Thrones podcast 10% off one order of $2,500 or less.
It's actually no longer the first time ever. It's like either been 1, 3, or 5 weeks.
Well, it's, the time is
it's
what
fun
is time?
Yeah,
you know?
Like maybe Bran is seeing all these advertisements at the same time, and he's also the Night King, and he wants to buy a sweet audio gear setup for the Three-Eyed Raven's cave when all this is over. Because you know the acoustics in there are tricky.
Yeah, they are.
How does he take advantage of that offer?
He can go to Sonos.com, look for any of their products, and get 10% off an order of $2,500 or less. It's available for a limited time only and cannot be combined with other discounts or promotions. But you can use the promo code GOT10, and that's capital GOT10, at Sonos.com to receive this exclusive offer.
For the final time in Season 7, I want to remind you that a great way to support Bald Move and everything we do here, because the only way we can do the depth of coverage and the breadth of coverage we have is by doing this full-time. We've been doing this for several years, and largely supported by the generosity of our listeners. And you can be part of those that community by going to club.baldmove.com, joining the club. It's not all altruism, folks. You get a lot of cool bonus material. If you like hearing Jim and I talk about stuff, we do a lot more of that on the club. We have first-run movies with full spoiler thoughts if you want to hear our thoughts on the latest movies coming out. We've got Quit Your Pitchin' and Lunch with Jim and Aaron, other bonus audio content, almost all of our podcasts. We film live. It's by far the quick. You can't get any quicker access to a podcast than watching a person make it. Mm-hmm. That's just science. Unless you're Bran Stark and you transcend the laws of the purely mundane. And I don't – if anyone does, like, that's – why you probably are a multi-lottery winner.
Also, can you get us screeners?
Yes, at the very least. Can you watch it a week in advance and give it to us? Because that would be sweet and helping us produce this podcast. Everybody else can support us by going to the club. If you're not clairvoyant, you can go to club.baldmove.com. Check it out, and hey, you get to try it for 30 days free just by signing up. Check it out, club.baldmove.com. Ben W., every time you talk about the Valonqar, you seem to settle on the conclusion that it would be most likely turn out to be Jaime. What about the fact that prophecy says hands, emphasis on the plural? Jaime's unable to accomplish that because of his complete lack of a set of hands, just a thought.
Okay.
I mean, he's got me.
Good point, yeah.
You're right. That's something we're all overlooking. He cannot wrap his hands, plural, around her pale throat and choke the life from her. Is that an actual concern?
Wow.
Because
kind of caught me flat-footed on this.
Here's the thing, though, Ben. There's also this symbolism of Tyrion choking out Shay. Mm-hmm. With a golden chain that's literally his one of his badges of office. It's interlocking links of golden hands holding onto each other. Mm. So there's already this, like, you know, hands of gold kind of mocking song. I wonder if that this is actually going to – because in the book, in the show, he's got this weird kind of, like, fetish – fisting ready, kind of like it's in the duck shape, ready to be inserted, kind of gold hand.
Uh-huh.
Like, it could be that he's got, like, you know, maybe he's got a gold hand ready for grasping.
Yeah, choking hand.
Yeah, and then he's just got to, because then you just got to get the gold thumb over the windpipe, your living hand over the other, and you got to push down.
Hmm.
I feel like I've thought too much about strangling Cersei at this point, and Jaime's gold fisting ready hand.
It's never too much when you're talking about strangling Cersei.
Or being fisted by Jaime. I mean, look at him. He's gorgeous. All right. So there's my attempt at, like, I mean, that's a good point.
I just don't know how closely they're going to follow it.
Also, you got people willing to bend the Valonqar rules to have Cersei wearing Jaime. Like, how what kind of a stickler, prophecy stickler, is Martin going to be,
yeah.
It turns out? That's all good questions. Sarah Z. We don't know if Jon is truly quote-unquote alive or just a fire white like Beric, but we do know that Book Beric finally dies when he passes his life force along to Lady Stoneheart. What if the only way that Jon and Dany can have a baby is for him to die and pass along his life to conceive a new one? If he sacrificed himself to begat an heir, that would fulfill all the tragedy we expect from Game of Thrones while possibly not mattering whether he's quote-unquote alive or not.
I wonder what that looks like on screen.
What? Passing one's life?
Yeah, passing your life force by killing yourself into a child. Like,
Here's the noodle bender.
Yeah.
I kind of think they're hinting at the fact that that Dany's already made this sacrifice, because they made a big point out of her saying these dragons are one-to-one my children.
Mm-hmm.
One of her, and she paid for those lives with the lives of Drogo and her unborn child and Miri Mazdur, and she got three dragons as a result of that. One of these children died, so is it possibly to be argued that the gods of Westeros owe her one?
Yeah, she's got one coming.
And now she's getting boned by Jon, and you know what happens when that happens. I mean, I wonder if this is already a done deal, that the Viserions died and there she's got a free one. She got a freebie. She got a one up. She's got a one up.
A dragon
mushroom
can pay for a baby. That's what the faceless men say, right?
Yeah. Only a dragon, or only a baby can pay for dragon. It's a fungible exchange rate. You can have one horse-mounted warlord, a middle-aged witch, stillborn child, and you put them all together, and you get three baby dragons in return. Richard from Austin, Texas. I don't know if you guys have discussed this theory, but what do you think, Gurm would end the series by having the White Walkers defeat the human race and controlling the Game of Thrones universe?
Sure. Sure, I think he could do that.
We haven't played that in a while. The old question, what is George Martin playing at?
Mm-hmm.
Is he trying to tell a cautionary tale of when, like, if humans can't get the shit together, and you know, when we're faced with some sort of implacable threat, we were helpless against it?
Yeah.
Is he telling a story that's just going to leave us completely gutted and wanting to die, like I was after The Red Wedding when I read it? And I literally had to stop reading the books for 2 weeks and save up the strength to continue on. I don't think so.
Yeah, I think whatever message you're trying to get across, there are a couple of ways of approaching it. One, you can show the consequences if you don't work together. Like, let's say, for instance, he's trying to say, yeah, this is what humanity can do if it works together, or what it deserves if it doesn't.
Right.
You can show the consequences, which is
that's how Tolkien did it. Like, you know, he has Frodo looking in the mirror and he sees all these horrific things that could happen if he doesn't have the strength to find it in him to take the ring and throw it in the mountain.
Yeah, it just so happens there are more movies after that, or more books after that, you know.
But it didn't have to actually come to pass for Frodo to see that it's a bad deal.
Right. So maybe at the end of this, it does come to pass. There's no moment where you look in the mirror. It's just that's the end, and you've now paid for your sins. But the other way to tell it is you overcome the things that are separating the people, and they all get together, and you show the results of harmony and unity.
Right.
And I think either of those could be a fitting into this series. It just kind of depends on what the guy wants to do.
Yeah, is he going to keep subverting fantasy tropes till the very bitter end?
Right.
Or is he going to try to find... I think a lot of people expect him to find some middle path where, like, it's the bittersweet ending that he's trying to steer towards.
Yeah.
Where it's not a soul stomper, but it's going to be maybe a tearjerker.
That's true. If he says bittersweet, I don't think the Night King ruling of the land is bittersweet.
That's
I think
that's
ash
bitter in your mouth.
Yeah.
Like, what does that even taste like?
Right. So I don't know where the sweetness would come from.
Probably
there.
Acidic. Volcanic ash, I'd imagine, is acidic.
Yeah.
It would taste like a sour. More of a sour, sour taste in your mouth.
I don't know. Go lick Iceland and find out.
I have a vial of Mount St. Helens ash. I could look at the, you know. That...
Yeah?
We got. Is it too late to do a stretch goal for the pod pack?
No, it's not.
At $10,000, Aaron will lick us Mount St. Helens. No, I will not. I will not do that. But yeah, I mean, that's who knows? I guess. I mean, we'll have a lot more confidence after next season to where, like, what kind of story George is going to tell, because I do find it very highly unlikely, unless George is just completely unethical in a way that I don't suspect, that the story is going to be radically different from the books to the show. So only have 12 to 18 months left to wait. Walt McSee, forgive me if you've already discussed this on a past recording, but after listening to last week's spoiler cast and discussion of Two Horns, Dragonbinder, and the Horn of Joramun, I was curious if you considered these two in relation to the cover art of The Winds of Winter. I'm sure you've seen the image, but I've attached it in any case. Back in 2016, on his blog, Gurm confirmed that the image is official, at least at the time. The horn featured on the cover seems to share similarities with both the Dragonbinder and Horn of Joramun, black in color, gold banding, derived from an aurochs, etc., and how they're described throughout A Song of Ice and Fire, though I'm curious if it may being featured indicates that there's still a role one of them play in Season 8, or whether it's more proof that the two narratives have forked and George's tale will take a much more different route to reach the same destination. With Season 7 behind us, I can imagine one or two being used in the books to either bring down the wall or used as a tool to tame an ice dragon. Your thoughts?
It's definitely a horn on the cover.
Yeah, that's the thing. So here's the thing. I was completely ignorant of this because, if you don't know, the people that are joining us, I really tried to, because I thought back in 2015 that The Winds of Winter was just around the corner, because he's releasing all these preview chapters and this stuff was coming out. And I stayed because I'm like, well, shit, if the book is going to come around, why do I want to read 7 or 8 unconnected chapters from it, half of them that were cut from Dance with Dragons anyway? Why don't I just wait a couple months and get the full effect?
Yeah.
I was forced to start delving into that material when I got assigned some panels at this Con of Thrones that essentially made me delve into that kind of stuff. So then it's like, but yeah, I had no idea this image was circulating and it was shown to be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that leaves me in a bad spot because, yes, it's likely in the books that there'll be, you know, obviously this Dragonbinder horn is going to be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what kind of thing it's going to be, but it's certainly in the world. It's speeding on the way towards Dany. What is it going to do? I don't know. The Horn of Joramun seems like it was introduced as a wildling threat that they could destroy the wall with it. Now, it later turns out that was just a bunch of bullshit, that they didn't actually have the Horn of Joramun. They had some fake thing that they found in some dragon or giant's barrow, and they were bluffing. But that doesn't mean that the horn doesn't actually exist, and the myths around it are not real, and that the Night King might not, with his thousands of years history, already have it in his possession.
Yeah, and we kind of discussed, you know, how the horn... There's a horn in the show that we think could have been the Dragonbinder horn.
When they found the cache of Dragonglass back in Season 2, yeah.
Yeah, but they kind of dropped it in the meantime. Mm-hmm. And we kind of talked about, you know, whether they would bring that back up, because they could, with a few previously ons, like you said.
Right.
They could certainly bring that back up. But at this point, like, now that the wall's down...
Mm-hmm.
Unless the Night King has that tucked in his back pocket, I don't really know why he would need the Dragonbinder, because he took down the wall with the dragon that he already controls.
Yeah.
So, like, is he going to control Drogon while Dany's sitting on him?
But you can see in the book where...
In the book, it's totally different.
Because in the preview chapters of Forsaken, they're like, you know, I talked about this theory about Euron maybe trying to make a bid for himself to be a dark god, or he might join himself to the others. And if he foolishly brings Dragonbinder with him, then it's possible that the Night King has both. He can steal a dragon without a use of a magic spear, and he can blow down the horn without the use of a magic dragon. And that's where it gets tricky, because, like I mentioned behind the scenes, the Double D's, when they talk about the dragon being turned, that seems like something they freestyled.
Right.
But it also has been speculated for as long as I can remember that there would be an ice dragon that the Night King has.
Mm-hmm.
So this could be them blending stuff for narrative economy. It could be they think it's a, you know, they've already got too far that they can't introduce these horns and this machinations from Night King. So this is just a way to kind of make it all blend seamlessly together. But I mean, I think a horn will be significant in the Winds of Winter, because the other thing is, like, I guess, you know, the ideas of the Winds of Winter is they blow.
Right.
Yep. And like, you got this horn that's blow, like, it's like also horns are sounded when things are in times of danger and distress. Like, there's also a lot of purely symbolic ways that that horn could be significant.
Yeah.
But
I mean, the wall coming down is one, right?
Yeah.
The horn's blown three times, and I know it's a different horn than the horn that you're talking about. But
That's the three horns for the others, and then it collapses at the end of that. That's, I mean, that you're right. That could be a little bit of a nod to the future book readers as well.
Yeah.
But it's tough because, again, like, who knows where the Double D's end and Martin begins and vice versa at this point. You just have to kind of piece it together from interviews, and until we get the books, it's very hard to see. John M., now that we know that John's true name is Aegon, what do you make of this quote from the books? This is from Daenerys, the first chapter in A Dance with Dragons. Five Aegons had ruled the seven kingdoms of Westeros. There would have been a sixth, but the usurper's dogs had murdered her brother's son when he was still a babe at the breast. If he had lived, I might have married him. Aegon would have been closer to my age than Viserys. This quote, plus Dany talking about marriage in Season 6, Episode 10, Littlefinger talking about them getting hitched this episode, the baby talk and a parallel between the last dragon and the wolf marriage makes it feel like this is definitely both where George is going and where the show is going. Yeah, it's interesting, because one of the surprising things that came out of my conversation with Kim is that she was very reluctant to accept the fact that Jon and Dany would become a thing. Whereas I mean, I guess from if I put my reader's hat on, as I always suspected they would be a thing, I just didn't think it would end happily.
Okay.
So it was kind of shocking that there was so much kind of mental resistance between George even putting them together, because you see stuff like this and you see, like I said, there was this cool Reddit post that like just round up like 20, 30 quotes in the first few books that kind of point to John being a king. And ruling that seemed like it always was a natural thing for them to do. I don't know. Did it shock you that John and Dany got together?
No. I mean, it's certainly like, I don't know. Within the universe, I don't have a problem with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of never
That implies that out of the universe, you do have a problem with it.
With incest? Yeah.
No. Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
Sure.
Again,
I totally do.
Firm line against incest in this podcast. We are a no incest having podcast.
Yeah. So I wasn't like as resistant to the idea.
And you can assume every other podcast out there that has not made a stern denouncement of incest is secretly incest supporters.
Yeah.
So I have to say that's just logic. I mean, why else wouldn't they condemn it?
I can't imagine there's a podcast out there that hasn't A, brought up incest, and B, come out against it.
Oh, there's a lot of podcasts out there.
That's true.
What about the Wincest Game of Thrones podcast?
The Winds of Wincest?
From the Mother-Son Boy Love Association. That's a real thing. I don't know why iTunes puts up with it, but you know.
You're right.
I was nipping at her heels, the Wincest podcast.
Yeah, I didn't have a big problem with it.
Okay.
And when it happened, I was like, yep, that totally feels right.
All right, well, that's it. It is a short spoiler week because Jim and I actually have to board a plane to fly to Chicago very early tomorrow. We usually record on a Friday, so that cuts the feedback in half. So it's a little shorter than normal, but we will, you know, again, spoiler section is no longer going to be its own podcast for the Season 2 podcast. It's most likely going to be just an add-on to the main podcast. It'll be at the very end, so people don't want to be spoiled. I don't know why I'm telling you this. Telling this to you because you guys are going to be all diving into it anyway, but it's not like we're going away. We'll still have another 10 plus weeks to discuss this stuff throughout our Season 2 coverage, which is kind of exciting because Season 2, again, great year, and we're going to see you know, one of the things will be interesting to debate is when we see this just cache a dragon glass they find at the Fist of the First Men, like actually, because it's been a couple years since I've laid eyes on that horn and see like, oh man, I wonder if that's something that could have happened. It's not going to, but it's going to be exciting. We're going to start it up next week. Send in all that stuff like you do normally. GameofThrones@baldmove.com. Of course, the forums are there for you to discuss it there. You can also follow along if you want to keep track of what we're doing on all the social medias, / or @baldmove. Yeah, season two coverage starts next week. We will be there. Hopefully you will too. Until the next time we see you, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Bye-bye.